The following is a presentation of VBR. Welcome, and thank you for joining us in our study of God's Holy Word.
Thanks for joining us again. We're in 1 Timothy chapter 5. Let's reread verses 1 and 2. Paul says to Timothy, "Do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father, younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, with all purity." In our last segment, we had discussed the first part of this first verse, how that Timothy might have occasion to bring a problem to an older man's attention. There might be something this older man needs to correct. And in a situation like that, how was Timothy to go about it? Well, he was to go about it with respect. This sentiment was taught in the Old Testament, and it's being taught here. However Timothy went about speaking to this older man, it needed to be with respect. He was not to rebuke him. He was not to go in and sharply reprove him. But rather, he says here in verse 1, he's to exhort him as a father. That word exhort we've encountered already in this book, and it's the Greek word parakaleo, meaning to urge strongly, appeal to, encourage. And he's to do it as a father. My father just passed away several months ago, and I speak of him in the past tense now, but thinking about how I might have approached him about any problem in his life, it would be something that would have needed to be done in humility. That humility and respect would have been reflected in my demeanor, my tone of voice, my word selection. Sometimes asking a question rather than stating something can help. Timothy might have occasion to speak to an older man about a problem, but he needed to do it respectfully. And by so doing, he would be far more likely to succeed and please his God. He's to exhort the younger men as brothers, indicating that he himself was a younger man. He was in that same category that was mentioned back in chapter 4, and it's affirmed again here. And we know how we would speak to a brother. In verse 2, he was to speak to older women as mothers, with the same gentleness and respect he would approach his mother with, and younger women as sisters, with all purity. That speaks for itself, but we can dwell on that for just a moment. It's right up there with a holy kiss. The brethren in the first century would greet each other with a kiss, Romans 16, verse 16. But it was to be a holy kiss, a pure kiss. There are, of course, impure kisses. Judas's was one, and there are other varieties. An evangelist in dealing with a younger evangelist, young man, dealing with sisters in the church near his own age must be especially careful never to compromise his integrity when interacting with them. He's going to be speaking with them in times when they're feeling vulnerable, when he may find himself in private situations with them, in situations where things could be handled incorrectly if his heart is not where it needs to be. So Paul instructs Timothy, be very careful in interacting with your sisters. Treat them, your sisters in Christ, treat them as you would your own physical sisters. With that said, starting now in verse 3, Paul is turning his attention to three critical matters in the church. And each of them is going to be introduced in terms of honor. In verses 3 through 16, he's going to talk about honoring widows. In verses 17 through 25, he's going to talk about honoring elders, as well as how to receive charges against an elder. And in chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, he's going to talk about servants honoring their masters. After chapter 6, verse 2, Paul's going to return to the issue of false teachers. Now, insofar as widows are concerned, Paul's going to talk about them quite a bit here. Widowhood could be a severe test in the Greco-Roman world in the first century. Women were not usually the direct heirs of their husband's will. The widow would be given a dowry and sometimes a stipulation which her deceased husband made for her care to his heirs, but She had to count on his sons to follow through. And if her sons or her husband's sons did not care for their mother, or as often was the case, their stepmother, she could find herself in a dire situation if her dowry was not substantial. They didn't have the safety nets in the first century that we do today. There were no government programs to help with widows. So the idea of taking care of a widow repeatedly presents itself to us all through the Scripture. James chapter 1, verse 27, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their trouble. We recall all the way back in Acts chapter 6 that the first seven deacons were appointed to deal with the issue of how to make sure the widows were receiving the care they needed, receiving the support they needed from the church's resources. What widows are eligible to be recipients of the church's resources is the question Paul now addresses in beginning in verse 3. Let's read verses 3 through 8. Honor widows who are really widows. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God. Now she who is really a widow and left alone trusts in God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. And these things command that they may be blameless. But if anyone does not provide for his own and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Paul says, as he begins this subject of the widows, he says, honor widows who are really widows. And by honor here, he does mean financial support from the church. Context is going to bear that out. In verse 4, you may have noted he uses the word repay. In verse 8, he uses the expression provide for. And then in verses 17 and 18 of this same chapter, when he's talking about the elders, he uses the word honor in the sense of financial support. He says there, let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in the word and doctrine. For the Scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. An elder is worthy of honor in the sense that he holds the position of a leader in the church, but he's also worthy of a second type of honor, a financial remuneration for his work. Widows were worthy of this type of honor, provided they met certain qualifications. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 2, when Paul quotes the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother, he uses this very same word. And we know that honoring your father and your mother has a financial component, because over in Mark 7, verses 9 through 13, we learn that the Jews had this tradition where an individual could donate, gift, some of his financial resources towards spiritual causes or religious causes, and this was called Corban, and by so doing, he no longer had to use that to take care of his aging parents. And Jesus said, by denying those resources to his parents, he was guilty of not honoring his father and his mother. So this connection between honor and financial support is well founded. Paul says that the church is to honor widows who are really widows, that is, widows who really need the support. In verse 4, he points out that the first line of defense for a needy widow is her family. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents. Your King James translates this word nephews, but the New King James, the New American Standard, the ESV, and the NIV all translate it grandchildren, and that is what it means. It means specifically lineal descendants, grandchildren. Well, why does the King James use the word nephews? Simply because in Old English, nephew was a word to refer to a grandson or other lineal descendant. So it's not that the King James is disagreeing with these other translations, it's just that the English language has changed. Her children or her grandchildren are the first line of defense if a Christian widow should find herself in financial need. Paul says, let them, the children and the grandchildren, learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents. Our parents did an awful lot for us all those years. They raised us up in their home, in many cases sacrificing on an enormous level. It's only appropriate that when they come to a place where they're in need, we should repay them. We are indebted to them. This idea of showing piety just simply means to show profound respect. Financially caring for your parents is a way of showing them respect, a way of showing them honor. And the word parent can mean ancestor, so it would apply to the grandchildren as well. Now, the widow, who is really a widow indeed, a widow who's really in need from the church, is one who, according to verse 5, trusts in God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. After her bereaved condition, Paul now lists the first qualification needed for a sister to be eligible to be taken into the church's care. She trusts in God, and she demonstrates it by persistent prayer. I'm reminded of Jesus' parable of the persistent widow. In Luke chapter 18, verse 5, she kept going to that unjust judge. He didn't care about God. He didn't care about her. But because she kept going, he said, "Yet because this widow troubles me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me." A widow indeed, a widow eligible for the church's help, is one who engages in continual coming to the Lord. She has responded wisely to her new status. She trusted in God before she lost her husband, and she still goes on trusting God after she loses him. She goes on trusting him, continuing to look to him in prayer, trusting in him to take care of her ultimately. And she prays to him when? Well, night and day, says Paul. She's praying without ceasing. We would say it day and night, but Paul was a Jew, and he thought of time as the Jews do, the evening and the morning. And so here, as in 2 Timothy 1:3, he speaks of praying night and day. A sister whom the church would support is a sister of persistent prayer. She is not, verse 6, a woman consumed with living a life of pleasure. Paul says, she who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives. This expression, lives in pleasure, is a single Greek word. To live a life of wanton pleasure, the New American Standard says. Self-indulgence, the ESV and NIV say. It just speaks to living in a life of complete self-indulgence beyond the bounds of propriety. And that is certainly very relevant to 21st century America. I was struck not long ago as I was reading through Luke chapter 12. I was struck by the parable of the rich man who had the great harvest. I don't recall ever seeing the parable in this way. You'll recall how beginning in verse 16 of Luke 12, this man had this tremendous harvest, such a great harvest that he didn't even have barns big enough to hold all the produce. And the entire parable takes place in his mind. He never actually does anything. And this rich man made a decision. He decided that he was going to tear down his present barns and build greater so they could house all the produce. Now, he hadn't done anything. He wouldn't have been doing anything wrong by doing that. But it's the next thing he decided that got him into trouble. He decided that once he had those bigger barns built and all that produce laid up for many years, he would then take his ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And I was struck by that because that sounds like the American retirement dream in 21st century America. To work hard, yes, all those many years, but to get that big nest egg and those investments so that you can retire and live the rest of your life having fun. There's nothing wrong with having fun. There's nothing wrong with enjoying the fruits of your labors. There's nothing wrong with a little entertainment and a little vacationing. But to make that the centerpiece of your life, this is contrary to the will of God. And to have a woman who's been recently widowed, who's been brought to face to face with the reality of death because what her husband has just experienced, she knows she herself will at some point experience. For her to respond to that reality by plunging headlong into a round of pleasure seeking tells the church a lot about her character. She's looking down. She's not looking up. She's not seeking first the kingdom of God. She's laying up for herself treasures on earth, not in heaven. And I'm sorry to say, I've seen this firsthand. It's quite a thing to see. I've only seen it once, but I've seen it. To respond to that grief and that new status by plunging into pleasure rather than plunging into prayer disqualifies a sister from being eligible for the church's help. Paul tells Timothy now in verse 7, these things command and teach that they may be blameless. That is, that all involved, the widows, the children, the grandchildren, that they can, so that they'll behave as they should in this matter. Now, verse 8 is a well-known verse. Paul says, if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. In light of the context, I think the NIV correctly conveys the intent of this verse. The NIV reads here, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And a household would contain bondservants as well in a world where they were part of the household, where they would have servants. They would be dependents as well. We are responsible for taking care of our own. This responsibility falls first and foremost on the father when he is of working age. The whole plan of God from beginning to end bolsters that truth. But in this context, children and grandchildren are to be there to take care of their widowed mother or grandmother. And if someone should choose not to do this, Paul says, he has denied the faith. Now, he may not have done so in word, but he's done so in conduct. He has acted as if the tenets of the faith are not true, because he has neglected a responsibility whose nature lies at the heart of the faith. What did James say in James 1:27? Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their trouble. He said, I'm not going to help her in her trouble. And so by making that decision, he has in his action denied the truth of the faith. Our actions speak for themselves. And they speak to others and to God about what's important to us, no matter what we say. I don't think Ralph Waldo Emerson actually said this, but he is reputed to have said, I believe, that your actions speak so loud that I cannot hear what you say. One who will not care for his aging mother or grandmother when he has the resources to do so, Paul says he's denied the faith and he's worse than an unbeliever. Even unbelievers, even non-Christians who have the work of the law written in their hearts, Romans 2:15, they take care of their family members. So to not do so is to put yourself in a pretty terrible category. Let's pick up in verses 9 and 10 now. Paul says, do not let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number, and not unless she has been the wife of one man, well reported for good works. If she has brought up children, if she has lodged strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has relieved the afflicted, if she has diligently followed every good work. She had to be at least 60 years old. Perhaps this was the age where remarriage was unlikely. Perhaps this is when a woman under 60 was still capable of working. Precisely why this age was selected, I can't say, but she needed to be at least 60 years old. And Paul says she needs to have been the wife of one man. Just like we had qualifications for elders and qualifications for deacons in chapter 3, here we've got qualifications for these widows. She needs to have been the wife of one man, almost exactly like the qualification for an elder. Here she's to be a one-man woman. She cannot have been a polygamist. She may have been remarried if her first husband died. There are no such thing as specter spouses. Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 3 makes it very clear that when our spouse dies, there's a marriage no longer. In chapter 5 here in 1 Timothy verse 14, Paul actually encourages the younger widows who are not qualified to be taken into the number. He encourages them to remarry. If remarriage after death of a spouse violates the qualification of being the wife of one husband, then Paul was encouraging the younger widows to purposely disqualify themselves from ever being eligible. And that doesn't seem sensible, and it seems out of step with the mercy of God. So, yes, a woman who had been married to a husband, but he had passed away and she had remarried, she would be the wife of one man. Can she have been divorced and remarried? Provided that the divorce was for adultery, perhaps. I'm sorry I can't be any more certain than that, but perhaps. But she most certainly, in verse 10, needs to have been well reported for good works. And what kind of good works? Well, Paul lists five of them. Number one, if she has brought up children. This woman was married. And it's a glorious thing in the eyes of God for a married woman to bring up children. Napoleon himself acknowledged that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. This has always been part of God's plan for a godly woman who is married. They can be her children by birth, they can be her children by adoption, or perhaps other children that have come into her care. Sometimes we know of situations where there will be a family that can't take care of children, or a mother, or just a bad situation where some children need to be taken care of, and someone related or someone known can end up raising those children. What the Lord seems to be looking for here is, has this woman in her married state given attention to domestic affairs, and has she brought up children in a way that would have pleased him? That is, if she was a Christian at the time. Has she brought up children? If she has lodged strangers. Now, this word, lodge strangers, just means to show hospitality, but it has the word stranger in it. And that's why the New King James and the New American Standard translate it that way. You'll recall that in the qualifications of the elders, 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, he was to be hospitable. And that word had the word for stranger in it as well. He's literally to be a lover of strangers. Why is it that hospitality is connected with strangers? Well, this is an important point. This woman, her home, needs to have been a place for more than just entertaining her friends and brethren. The question is, has it been a place that was open to strangers? And in 21st century America, this is kind of a scary thing for us. The world's getting to be a darker and a more frightening place, and the thought of opening up our home to people we don't know can be a little frightening, but the New Testament affirms this. In Matthew 25, verse 35, Jesus on the judgment day says to the righteous, I was a stranger and you took me in. And he says just the opposite to the unrighteous, I was a stranger and you didn't take me in, implying you should have done so. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 2, the writer says, do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. There's a blessing that comes with opening your home to strangers. Has her home been open, even to those she didn't know? These are some of these good works. If she's brought up children, if she has lodged strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet. In the ancient East, it was an act of hospitality to provide water for the feet of your guests. Of course, they'd been out on those dusty, dirty roads in sandals, and washing the feet would be a real blessing. Abraham, you'll recall, brought out water for those three men in Genesis 18, verse 4, to wash their feet. When Jesus was in the house of Simon the Pharisee, he brought this up. Here was this woman, this sinful woman who had come in, and she was washing Jesus' feet, and Simon in his heart was scowling about what Jesus was permitting here. And Jesus simply said to him, Luke 7:44, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You haven't shown a common act of service and hospitality. Washing the feet of someone, or at least providing the water, was an act of hospitality, and the actual act of washing the feet was the job of a servant. In 1 Samuel 25, verse 41, when David asks Abigail to become his wife, she says to him, here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. This is why Peter reacted the way he did to Jesus washing his feet. He said, Lord, are you washing my feet? Are you doing what a servant does? You're not my servant. I'm your servant. But of course, Jesus had a lesson to teach him there. But this was an act of service. And it was a very practical act of service. If this expression is intended literally here, I think we need to put it in the same category as a holy kiss and holy hands. Washing the feet, lifting up hands, kissing, these were common practices in the first century church. They're not common now. The important thing is if you're going to pray, it needs to be holy. If you're going to kiss, it needs to be holy. And the important thing here is she needs to have been one who served the saints. It may be that this expression is just being used idiomatically, like rolling out the red carpet, killing the fatted calf, going the extra mile. Simply put, is she someone who has humbly served the saints, drawing on Jesus' example of humble service in John 13? Her fourth good work is if she's relieved the afflicted. She who would be relieved by the church in her affliction will have done the same for others when she was able. She's without resources now, but when she had them, how did she use them? Did she use them to help others who were in need? And finally, Paul says, if she's diligently followed every good work. Now, this, of course, doesn't mean she was to be perfect, but what's been typical of her life? Has she been someone engaged in good, godly works? This harkens back to chapter 2. In chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, Paul said that the women needed to adorn themselves with good works, which was proper for a woman professing godliness. This godly widow will have good works in her history. And with these qualifications, she would be qualified to receive the church's financial support. Beginning in verse 11, Paul's going to have some more things to say about the nature of her commitment to the church when she received financial resources. But, and so, Lord willing, we'll talk about that in our next segment.